All right. We're down in chapter 2, and our dear brother Solomon has been seeking for the chief good through the use of pleasure in verses 1 through 12. And then starting at verse 13, we see the despair that he comes to because death comes to all. And so we're down to verse 20 now in Ecclesiastes chapter 2. And the despair he goes through because death comes to all. And it doesn't matter whether you're wise or whether you're a fool, you still die the same. Therefore I went about to cause my heart to despair of all the labor which I took under the sun. And the reason why, and he was even going to allow despair to come in to see what that would do. And allow despair. See, he's, by wisdom, searching out every aspect of human experience. And then verse 21, for there is a man whose labor is in wisdom, and in knowledge, and in equity. Yet to a man that has not labored therein, shall he leave it for his portion. This also is vanity and a great evil. I mean, this really upsets him. Because here he is, wise, and then guess what his son is, and it's actually going to happen. His son, Rehoboam, steps into the throne. The first thing he does is a very unwise thing, and boom, the kingdom is split in half. And Rehoboam only got the smaller portion of it. And so that means as far as taxes and things like that, they were cut way back. Because now the northern kingdom, which had most of the tribes, and most of the people, were getting most of the taxes. And so Rehoboam took this unwise stance of putting a heavier yoke upon the people, and he lost them. This is a great evil. Verse 22. For what has man of all his labor and of the vexation of his heart, wherein he hath labored under the sun? What does he have? See, what he gets, he leaves to another. So what does he really get out of it? If what he labors for, he leaves to another, what does he really get out of it? You know, what does it do for him? Verse 23. For all his days are sorrow, and his travail grief. Yea, his heart takes not rest in the night. This is also vanity. See, and the harder he tries, the less rest he gets. And so here he's trying to come up with all this perfection, and what good was it? He just wears him out. And he's going to leave it for somebody else. So, this brings us to the first main conclusion, starting in verses 24 to 26. This is the first main conclusion, and we're going to see this conclusion repeated throughout the book. There is nothing better for a man than that he should eat and drink, and that he should make his soul enjoy good in his labor. This also I saw, that it was from the hand of God. Now remember, Solomon is inspired. He's the wisest man on earth. He's receiving this from the Lord, although he is viewing it in the natural way. He's viewing it through the natural scheme, but he's receiving God's conclusion. The conclusion is, since you're going to leave it to another and it's not going to end up your own anyway, and all that labor is basically going to be lost, therefore the best that you can do is enjoy what you do. Amen. That's the best you can do. If you've got to be on the treadmill, you may as well enjoy it while you're on there. Enjoy all you can along with your labors, because you're on the treadmill. You've got the labors. You have to do it, so enjoy it while you're at it. Do what will give you the greatest joy and the greatest benefit while you're there. This is one of the reasons why it's so good to get rid of that demon of perfectionism. Because that thing tries to tell you that the chief good is attainable in this life. That's what that demon does. It tries to pressure you into an impossibility. And force you, and it'll make you unfulfilled in everything you do. Dissatisfied in everything you do. Legalism will do the same thing. Nothing is good enough. Nothing is good enough. Instead of following the commandment here of the Spirit of the Lord, and that is, enjoy everything that you do. No matter whether it be good or bad or whatever. You get the best out of everything that you do. If you've got something to eat, enjoy it when you eat it, whether it be beans or stuffed pheasant. If you've got something to drink, enjoy it while you drink it, whether it be mineralized water that smells horrible. You know, if you've ever had that stuff, that water that just smells awful, or if you've got the best of wine, you know, whatever you've got, enjoy what you've got.
And that'll be the best thing for you. Verse 25. Who can eat, or who else can hasten hereunto more than I? Now he says, who can have better than what I've got? Nobody. I've got the best in the whole world. The Queen of Sheba, who was rich, who had that Saudi, the Arabian peninsula there, I believe, and from southwest Arabia, and loaded with gold, and was a very wealthy kingdom. She came, and there was no spirit left in her after she saw Solomon. I mean, this was the wealthiest kingdom on earth under Solomon. And he said, who could do better than I? He says, nobody, as far as that goes. And yet, what I have is a total waste. Therefore, the best anybody can do is enjoy what he's got. And if you can enjoy your beans more than I can enjoy my stuffed pheasant, then you're doing better than I am. That's the truth. It's the truth. If you're living in an apartment that's all beat down and broken down, and you've got joy therewith, you are doing better than the guy that's got a mansion and is not satisfied because the house isn't clean today. You know? I mean, you've got to have the enjoyment of your heart, and that's the best you can do. And this is from the hand of God, remember. It's from the hand of God. Let me move on to verse 26. For God gives to a man that is good in his sight wisdom and knowledge and joy. Now, he will give you those things because you will be able to get greater joy in this life if you do have those things. Because he that is wise has his eyes in his head. The fool walks in darkness. And so God will give you those things because you'll be able to get the better out of this life with knowledge and wisdom and joy. But to the sinner he gives travail, to gather, to heap up, that he may give to him that is good before God. This also is vanity and vexation of spirit. Why? Because even after all that is done, they still both die. They still both die. The righteous dies too. And so the best he can do is get the best out of what he's got when he's got it. Paul?
Isn't that similar to what Paul said, where he said, I've learned to be content in all things?
Yep. Absolutely. Whatever state I am, I've learned therewith to be content. Let me give you a couple of New Testament scriptures here. In Luke 16 and verse 9. Now this takes it another step higher, I'll admit, but, and I say unto you, make yourselves friends of the mammon of unrighteousness, that when ye fail, or when it fails, they may receive you in everlasting habitations. So use this world's good to make friends. Use what you got to make friends. And there it talks about making friends as far as good works and also other Christians by giving to him that has not. And in other words, take advantage of everything within your hands and find the best good out of it. Learning to be content. Learning to be content in whatever state that you are in. That verse would be a good one to add to there. That's Tim, let's see.
Philippians 4:12.
Thank you. Philippians 4:12. I know both how to be abased and I know how to abound. Everywhere and in all things I'm instructed both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need. So he's found out that in every state that he is, he's going to get the best out of that state, whatever it is, no matter what it is. He's going to learn from it. He's going to get joy in his heart the best he can out of that situation. Philippians 4:12. We're also going to see that another scripture will come to you later, but let me give it to you now, and that is godliness with contentment is great gain. 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verse 6. But godliness with contentment is great gain. Verse 7. For we brought nothing into this world, and it is certain we can carry nothing out. And having food and raiment, let us be therewith content. So 1 Timothy 6, 6 through 8. Yes.
Could you explain the phrase in verse 26, that you may give to him that is good before God?
Yes, basically, because the Lord is against the wicked and for the righteous, the wicked does all this labor and gathers up all of this, and then the righteous is going to step into it and get it. Mm-hmm. And see, they often had that happen when they defeated the armies of the alien. Mm-hmm. They gathered up all those riches, and they go in and wipe them out, and they take the riches and spoil themselves. And so ultimately, that's what happens. Ultimately, that's what will happen. And in the new earth, that's exactly what's going to happen. The meek shall inherit the earth. So, God is for the righteous, and he is against the sinner. And Solomon watched this happen. Solomon watched this happen in his kingdom and in his life.
And so this is a truth that is observable. See, remember, we're only judging that which is observable.
Mm-hmm.
We're also going to talk about this a little bit later, but he takes God into the picture. And you say, well, God isn't observable. Oh, yeah, he is. Yes, he is. The visible things of him declare his invisible nature and his Godhead.
Mm-hmm.
They're seen from the visible things. And so visibly, one who is a natural man acknowledges God. A wise natural man will acknowledge God. Because of the order, because of the perfection, because of the majesty and the magnitude of everything in God's creation. And so the honest, unsaved man will acknowledge that there is a God. Only a fool said there's no God. And so God is part of the picture. So, be content. Now let's press on. Chapter 3. Chapter 3, 4, and 5 are three chapters where Solomon seeks the chief good through general observation. General observation. In chapter 3, he starts out by pointing out how everything seems to work together. There seems to be a set time for everything that happens. And yet the reasons and the forces behind them cannot be seen. And he finds that life has, for every action, an opposite and equal reaction. And therefore, everything ultimately ends up in a balance. Everything ultimately ends up in a balance as far as over a period of time. And so life, therefore, is not like a rocket that takes off and ends up in the atmosphere and stays there. But it's like a pendulum. It swings back and forth and back and forth and eventually comes to a balance of sorts. Going back and forth. So let's look at this, what he has observed in chapter 3. To everything there is a season and a time to every purpose under the heaven. A time to be born and a time to die. And there's a beginning, but there's an end. See, and that's what this life is like. It's not like there's a time to be born and then you go on and on and on and on and you never die. And that's just the way it goes. And it's not that way. Time to be born, but there's a time to die. All life is like that. For every baby, there's a grandpa and a grandma with their wrinkled face that are smiling at it, you know. For every birth, there's a death. A time to plant, and a time to pluck up that which is planted. That's right. You ever notice these spitzers out here? There's a time to plant them, and then they get big and gangly and ugly and out of sorts, and you got to pull them out and put a new one in. Time to pluck up that which is planted. You've seen orchards. They'll do that with orchards. The orchards can last only so many years. Then you've got to pull them up and plant new plants again. A time to kill and a time to heal. There's a time to kill, but there's a time to heal. But then there's another time to kill. But then there's another time to heal. You see, they're set over against each other and they're opposites. And they ultimately balance out each other. They ultimately do. Over all of life. A time to break down and a time to build up. You got both. There we are downtown Seattle, building, then blowing up old buildings. And then the ones that are there, eventually they'll be blown up, you know, taken down. You know, I mean, it's going to happen. There's a time set against each other. A time to weep and a time to laugh. There's a time to cry, and you should cry. There's a time to laugh, and you should laugh. And they're set against each other. Make sure you get the right one the right time. A time to mourn and a time to dance. There's a time to dance, and there's a time to mourn. You know, when it's time to worship before the Lord, worship before the Lord. When it's time to be on your face crying out after God, get on your face and cry out after God. And try to find out and know which time is which. A time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones together. You know, they cast away stones out of the field. I hate these stones. But then they go out and gather stones to build their house. So one time you're rejecting them and hating them. Another time you're gathering them and glad for it. It may also refer to the setting up of boundary lines for land ownership, because they would often do that with stones and set pillars of stones. Time to set your boundaries, and there's a time to tear them down. A time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing. That's right. You got both set against each other. And we find that out in our church. There's in each movement of the Spirit. It's interesting. God will want to do something. There's always those that say, hey, why, you know, I like the old better or something. They don't want to move into the new. It's a time to embrace. They say, well, what about the time to not embrace? Hey, what happened to all the prayer? You know, God moves a new thing and legally stands back and judges it and says, well, what about this over here? There's a time for that. There's a time for this. Just get in with God and do what He wants you to do now. We've been doing it the old way for years and it didn't do that much good. Let's follow God. A time to get and a time to lose. There's a time to demand your rights. Yeah. And there's a time to relinquish your rights. There's a time to keep and a time to cast away. Some things you want to keep for yourself, some things you don't want. You don't want them anywhere around. You got to set the one against the other. A time to rend and a time to sow. That's right. There's a time to make that new sweet garment. There's a time out of mourning or grief or terror to rend it. Each is set against the other. And there's a time to rend. There really is. There's a time to sow. There really is. There's a time to keep silence and a time to speak. That's right. There is a time to keep silence. There's a time not to say anything. And there's a time that not to say anything would be a great damage. There's a time to speak. You should speak. Know which is which. They're set against each other. A time to love and a time to hate. Yeah, the two opposite extremes of emotion. Time to love and a time to hate. There's a time to really hate. There is. There is a time to really hate. And there's a time to really love. And we need to know those times and move into them. A time of war and a time of peace. That's right. There is. It's not always a time of peace. There is a time of war. There's times you need to fight. And there's times you need to rest and be at peace. Now, verse 9. What profit has he that works in that wherein he labors? Why does he ask that question? Because these things are opposites. Aren't they? Every one of these things are opposites. So, where do you end up at? Where do you start at? So, what profit is he in all his labor? Because these things go in a cycle. So, what are you? You're on your treadmill. Verse 10. I have seen the travail which God has given to the sons of man to be exercised in it. I have seen the travail. This is his conclusion. It's a travail. It's a treadmill. It's a treadmill. And so, why resist these things? You know, you've got to be on it, but it's a travail. That is, it's a labor without benefit. It's a wind that God has given to the sons of men to be exercised in it. We're all put on it, and there's no ultimate, a time of love all the way up until glory, and then you're done. No, there'll be a time of hate. There's no time of building until you build the Tower of Babel and go all the way to heaven, and then you just stay up there, and then you just turn into gold and stay there forever. It doesn't happen. You build the thing up, and it gets torn down. So we're exercised. We are. And you don't finally come into the ultimate, I got my deliverance. Glory to God. And I'm done with the deliverance. No more demons for me. Demon free. Hallelujah. Glory. Yeah, you got your deliverance yesterday. And you'll need another one tomorrow. Man cannot keep himself an hour clean. Praise the Lord, I'm done with that demon. Now it's all she wrote. You're on, headed on to glory. Would it be nice, or would it? If you could just pray the perfect prayer for an hour and just press into God with all the intercession, and every need would ever be supplied, you could just rest now and go to glory. Brethren, we're down here in a life in which there is no chief good. It's not here. And so you're going to be exercised continually and consistently in this life down here. Always. Always. Yeah, the one set against the other. Wouldn't it be nice if you could just sit down for 5 hours and just teach your kids everything there is to know and put it in them and then just be done with it. And now they're just perfect kids from now on to glory. They'll probably be disciplining the whole 5 hours because it's so hard to stand and sit still. And after it's done, they'll forget half what you said. And then see, it just doesn't work that way. You just got to be constantly, constantly on the treadmill. Constantly on the treadmill. But there's a time of rest, too. And you got to know when that is so that you don't burn out. There's a time of rest. See? There's a time to labor and there's a time to rest. You've got to know the one against the other. And the forces behind it aren't seen. All we know is that we're just exercised. We're on the treadmill. Now, verse 11 is a really important verse. He hath made everything beautiful in his time. And it's true.
In its time, war did a perfect thing. And in its time, peace did a perfect thing. In its time. Just get it in its time. Oh, and remember, you notice how with the three friends versus Job, the three friends had a lot of good to say, right? But it wasn't in his time. It was misapplied. So having it in his time is a real important key if you want to live this life the way it should be lived. Also, he has set the world in their heart, that is, in the heart of man, so that no man can find out the work that God makes from the beginning to the end. Now, what does that mean? He has set the world in their heart. You'll never understand it through the King James translation, that's for sure. The term world in the Hebrew is olam. Actually, it's ha-olam, which is the eternity. The eternity. God has set eternity in their heart so that no man can find out the work that God makes from the beginning to the end. This word olam, it comes from the basic idea of being concealed, a vanishing point. It's time out of mind. It's eternity. It means also always. It's from a root meaning to veil from sight or to conceal. The same term is found at least four other places in Ecclesiastes and is translated forever in each place. Chapter 1, verse 4. Chapter 2, verse 16. Chapter 3, verse 14. And chapter 9, verse 6. What is this eternity that God has placed in the heart of man? I'll tell you what it is. It's his spirit. It's that which causes his soul to live forever and ever and ever and ever and ever. You see, animals do not have a spirit. There is no inclination in an animal to worship God. None. You'll never secretly find Fido behind the, you know, by his doghouse, you know, howling to the moon. Uh-oh, maybe they do worship. You never secretly find him praying and seeking God, you know. You're never repenting of his sins. Never try to win a cow to the Lord, you know. After I got saved, I'll never forget it. I was saved, it was just a short time, and I was in the 9,000th heaven. And it was one evening after a Bible study, and the glory of the Lord was so present. And I was floating on campus, PLU. And I was walking along, and a little dog walked by. And I looked on that dog with such compassion. I grabbed him up and I said, if you could only know Jesus. And I wanted to win him to the Lord. You know, I just felt like, you know, I knew it was foolish, you know, but I just felt, if he could only know Jesus, you know. It was just a real unusual experience, okay? And thinking about that. But he didn't have a spirit. There was nothing in him. If I spoke in tongues at him, it didn't mean any difference. It didn't do anything to him. See? He can be influenced by my spirit and by the spirit of the Lord. He can be influenced. But I should say by my spirit through the spirit of the Lord. And he can be influenced by people's spirits through demons. But he cannot, you know, he does not have any spirit in himself. His soul will just be acted upon. He won't know what's going on. He has no desire to worship God. And yet men all over the earth have always worshipped God. Gods. They've always worshipped God. There is always an awareness of the eternal. This eternity in man is what some call a God-shaped vacuum. It's something that can only be filled by the Eternal One. This is why Paul says we are subjected in hope. Because our subjection is not just an existential subjection like animals, where they just die and then that's it. They cease to exist. But we've got something inside of us that's eternal. And it won't let us rest. See? And it's constantly looking for that which is eternal. Constantly. And you know what it makes people do? It makes people treat money like it's eternal. It makes people treat friendships like they're eternal. It makes people treat relationships like they're eternal. Materialism like it's eternal. Their own abilities as if they were eternal. And it's all a lie. But they got this thing inside of them. And the only way it's going to be satisfied is in God. That's why the things that are temporal are so horrible and frustrating and vain. Now to a dog, it's no problem. He doesn't care. He doesn't even think about it. I mean, it's not even in him. All he knows, he's just going by instinct and by his soul and his understanding. He doesn't care about anything else. See, God has made his eternal power and Godhead, it says in Romans 1 and verse 20. He's made it known to that which is visible. His eternal power and Godhead. Eternal power and Godhead. And so that we are aware of an eternal one. And that awareness of an eternal one makes us want to reach into that eternal state. And that's why all people on the face of the earth have got those high aspirations and goals that animals don't have. Because they're reaching out for that eternal thing. And we always are substituting those things that are temporal into its place. If I could just buy that new car. And because they are not satisfied in God and seeking after God, they allow that thing to enter into an eternal thing. And that's why it's so frustrating after they've had it for a month. That's why it's such a letdown. And this is what you find people that rush after money. They get their first million. They always wanted to be a millionaire. They became a millionaire. Guess what? They're not satisfied because their neighbor's a 2 millionaire.
Right.
And so they become a 3 millionaire. Now they're not satisfied because the other neighbor is a 5 millionaire. And so they work and they work and they work and they labor and they finally get 10 million. But now they're shooting for the big boys. Now he knows about a billionaire. He's still not satisfied. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear satisfied with hearing. And what is he trying to do? He's trying to satisfy Olam inside of him by that which is temporal, and you can't do it. You can't do it. And so he's constantly in a frustration. Notice what it says. God hath put eternity in their hearts so that no man can find out the work that God makes from the beginning to the end. Because we have eternity in our heart, therefore we cannot find out God's work in that which is under the sun. God's work from beginning to end is referring to that which is under the sun. So all this work that God has said in here, we can't find it in it because it's not there. It's not there. You can't find God's work in this temporal life because it's not here. All our striving and straining to be all this perfection and all these temporal things is a joke. Because there's Olam inside of you. And the only way that's going to be satisfied is in the eternal realm. It's the only way. Because you can't find out your work on this. See, we could be satisfied with this life if we didn't have Olam inside. But since you've got Olam inside, this life is vanity of vanities. All is vanity. And you'll be just like Solomon. You'll hate life. That is, you will hate your life and lose it.
Yeah.
That you might find it.
Yeah.
That's right. You'll hate everything that you have and own. Because it is not eternal. And it does not produce eternal life. And you will seek after only those things that will feed the Olam. That will minister to that God-shaped vacuum. Yeah. Olam comes from the idea of being concealed or veiled from sight. But it means eternity. Forever. Speaks of that which is totally out of time. God is called Olam. I mean, the term is clearly eternal. And it's translated that way throughout the Old Testament. Everlasting, eternal, always, forever. You know, that's the idea. In Psalms 90, verses 1 through 5, this is Moses. Lord, thou hast been our dwelling place in all generations. Before the mountains were brought forth, or ever thou hast formed the earth and the world, even from everlasting to everlasting, thou art God. Thou turnest man to destruction, and sayest, Return, ye children of men. For 1,000 years in eyesight are but as yesterday, when it is past, and as a watch in the night. Thou carriest them away as with a flood, they are as asleep. In the morning they are like grass which grows up. So look at what we are compared to God. We're like asleep. Remember what it was like last night? It's gone. I don't know about you, but I went, and then, and it's gone. That's what we're like. Compared with God, for him, 1,000 years is as but, you know, yesterday. Remember what yesterday? How long did yesterday last? It's gone. You begin to start counting time by months. You know, the older you get. Talked to this one old guy, really old, witnessing to him. He says, yeah, the last 15 years have sure gone fast. And I was young. I said, the last 15 years, I mean, that's 2/3 of my life, you know. I mean, that's half of my life, 15 years. And he says, yeah, it sure went fast. I talk about a month that way. He talks about 15 years that way. And that's true. The guy was just kind of in a blur. He was just racing towards the grave. What is life? See? Nothing, but as a sleep.
So, it says in John 1:9, it says that Jesus, that light, lightens every man that cometh into the world. There is a light in each one of us, a conscience, an awareness of an eternal verities in every one of us. And that thing that we have in each one of us causes us to be dissatisfied with all that is temporal and all that is in this life, because it never brings a chief good. And yet we keep telling ourselves it does. And so man is rushing after wind. Rushing pell-mell after wind. And he's dying and going to hell because of it. He's losing it. So that man can, it says here in verse 11, so that no man can find out the work that God makes from the beginning to the end. So that no man can find out. Now, NES has in his note a little bit different translation on this last phrase. It says, without which man will not find out the work that God makes from the beginning to the end. Without which man will not find out. And the ones who follow that reasoning are J. Green, Youngs, Rotherham, and Clark. But the ones that follow King James are NIV, Smith, Lang, and Lang says the Septuagint, the Syriac, the Targum, and the Vulgate follow the King James, Ellicott, JFB, and Kyle and Dillage. There's also a possibility that it could be read that he hath also set eternity in their heart, except that no man can find out the work, which is more like the King James. And so if you take it this other way, like the NES note, it would mean that you've got eternity, and unless you use your eternity, you're not going to find out what God is really doing in this life. And that's also a true concept. You really don't know what God is doing in this life unless you follow your eternity inside. The King James is saying, like I already taught you, that this eternity inside causes you to be frustrated with this life because it's a travail and a vanity. Personally, I prefer the King James translation because, number one, the scholarship seems to lean that way. Number two, the context is how we cannot find the chief good. And so it seems to lean towards the context. The context is that we cannot find the chief good under the sun. And thirdly, beginning to end seems to point to time limits. Beginning to end. And time limits, therefore, would be that which is under the sun. Because it's light that sets the standard of time, you know. Light sets the standard of time. It really does. So, therefore, it's referring to under the sun. Both ways, either way you take it, is a truth. But I prefer it just like the King James. All right, so continuing on. For the King James? Okay, without which man will not find out is the NAS note, J. Green, Youngs, Rotherham, and Clark. The ones like the King James are the NIV, Smith, Lang, along with Septuagint, Syriac, Targum, and the Vulgate, Ellicott, JFB, and Kyle and Dillage. Okay. Verse 12, I know that there is no good in them, but for a man to rejoice and to do good in his life. What is good in them? Since they're all temporal, and it's all going to be fleeting, and it's going to bring no chief good, what's the best you can do with it? Get the best out of it you can. In other words, use each fleeting day as a fleeting joy. That's the best you can do. And also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor. It is the gift of God. It's a gift of God that you enjoy eating and drinking. It is. If you overeat and overdrink, you ruin it. That's no good. That brings you into travail and pain. But your body is made to desire to eat and drink. And so it's good to work. And the more you function in the body, the better off it feels. You know, because you work hard, Your body feels good. There is an actual... In fact, I read an article one time where it talks about the runners who get high. You know, they get high on running. There is a definite a chemical balance that is stabilized in the body system through exercise. There's a definite chemical effect and balance in the system that is established through exercise. And so there are some people that that are in deep depression. You know, one of the real important remedies is exercise.
Right.
Hard exercise.
Yes.
To just work it and work it. And it lets off the frustration. There's an actual chemical release in the body. It's just like sleep. It's an actual chemical effect. God has made our body to enjoy sleep. Made our body to enjoy exercise. You know, to get a benefit out of it, of sorts, I think. And God has also made the body to enjoy to eat, but it's only if you get hungry. But then you get to feed it. But then it gets hungry again. But then you get to feed again. So you're not going to have any cheap good out of it. But the benefit is to eat moderately and to eat it when it, feed it when it's hungry, and then enjoy it. And if it's only hungry for one piece of toast, eating that one piece of toast, you'll get more enjoyment out of it than if you eat two and stuff yourself. So you see, there's a balance in it because it's no cheap good. So there's no cheap good in eating. If you could just sit down and eat about 2 tons of food all in one day and just be done for the life, and if you could enjoy every bite, then great. Now you'll eternally go on that food. But see, it doesn't work that way. So the best thing to do is enjoy what you got the best you can. And if you're cheap, and see, why do some people overeat? I'll tell you why they overeat. Because there's an olam inside of them. There's insecurities.
Yeah.
And there's a desire for the eternal. And there's a desire to be loved and accepted and to come into that ultimate place. And because it's not being satisfied, and there's a nervousness, there's a tension, there's an infulfillment, there's an insecurity, they feed their mouth because of the pleasure it brings to their soul. And they're not feeding their body, they begin to feed their soul.
Yeah.
And the body is done and the soul is not. And they keep feeding their soul and they overeat. And it ends up putting their body under stress. In fact, I read one study one time that says that there is more damage in the body to overeat than there is to undereat. The body handles undereating better than it handles overeating. Body systems function better. And I'm not sure how conclusive that was. They said it wasn't an absolute conclusive thing, but it appeared that way, so, which is kind of interesting. And you know people that have lived under torture and gone years and years and years on just rations, you know, their bodies come out strong. I mean, they can come out strong. They've got, you know, there's certain weaknesses in all of this, you know, and it's not like it should be, but but then you look at our obese society, you know, there's a lot of obesity in America. And of course, you know, the types of food and everything else like that. But see, a lot of it is because of insecurity. Well, maybe not a lot of it. Some of it. Who knows how much of it? I won't be the judge of that. But you see what I mean? It's because they're feeding their soul. And you can't feed your soul with food. You've got to feed your soul with something else. And so they use eating as a placation to the nervousness and the upsetness and the insecurities of the soul. So to enjoy eating and drinking is to do it moderately. And let it fill its place. Don't let it come any higher than it should. Don't let it enter into olam. Keep it down where it is. Keep it right where it is. And then you can enjoy it. This is also the gift of God. Because God puts it in your body to really enjoy that. To really enjoy it. To get good out of it. See, it's a blessing. Mealtime is always to be a blessing. To be an enjoyment. Something you have to do every day. Have to do it every day. 2 or 3 times a day or whatever, however you operate. You know? You have to do it every day. Okay, going on. Verse 14, I know that whatsoever God doeth, it shall be forever. Nothing can be put to it, nor anything taken from it. And God doeth it, that men should fear before Him. Now, whatever God does, it's done. And that just settles it. It's just done. That settles it. But He's the only one that does it, and that settles it. We never do anything that settles it. It's only God. And so He has got the ultimate control of all things. And He's kept everything under vanity. He's got everything controlled under vanity. And so nothing has its ultimate end. Verse 15. That which hath been is now, and that which is to be has already been, and God requires that which is past. In other words, there's no time to God. He sees your life, He sees where you're headed, He sees where you're going. There's no time to Him, and He's demanding it from you. He's demanding it from you, the effect of all of life. And there's going to be an ultimate judgment. We'll see that He brings that into light later. Verse 16. And moreover, I saw under the sun the place of judgment, that wickedness was there, and the place of righteousness, that iniquity was there. In this life, nothing seems perfect. There's a great overlap. You know, we tend to grow up with these idealistic, perfectionist type ideas, and that's because of Olam inside of us. You know, when you grew up in the high school, and our high school is great and eternal and the wonder of the ages. You know, and my dad is the greatest dad in the whole universe. And my mom is, and I have the greatest, and this and that. See, and we tend to idealize all those things. And that's because of the Olam within. But then we come into life, and we begin to realize it's not quite that way. It's just not quite that way. And many grew up in a sheltered kind of environment, and then they go out to the big college. And all of a sudden, they find everything that they always knew was the eternal standard of everything is being attacked and assailed on, and many other alternatives are given. And it can be quite a shocking experience for people. Well, now that secular humanism has seeped down from the secondary level, or the graduate level, down at college level, down into the secondary level, and even the primary level, now you go through the shock all through life and watching the boob tube and everything. All the values and the standards keep getting knocked down and torn apart, and it really does violence to the Olam in man, because it's looking for an eternal standard. For somebody to say there is no standard is a real shockaroo to the system. Because we are got that thing inside of us that knows that there's a standard and that there's an ultimate. We tend to put it on the wrong thing, though, see? We put it on our parents. They're the ultimate. And we tend to put it on other things, see? But it's God who is the ultimate. He is the ultimate standard. He is the absolute. And our spirit goes to Him, see? But in this light, there's no ultimate great. I saw the place of judgment, the wickedness was there, and the place of righteousness, that iniquity was there. That's just the way it is. It's not like you make a certain decision and you're totally clean. It just isn't that way. You may have made that decision for the wrong motives. It may have been the right thing to do, but the wrong reason. I mean, it's just too complex. And so you go to the place of judgment and you find iniquity. The judge made all these right decisions, but he blew it on that one. Or his motive wasn't quite right that day, you know. And then you go to the place of iniquity, and guess what's there? Righteousness. You know, you go there, a little bit of righteousness there. And it's not just a cut and dry thing in this life. You go to the place of judgment where righteousness should be, and wickedness is there. See? And you go to the place of righteousness, and the place of righteousness, iniquity was there. And so you find out that it's not just, you know, it's just not that way. And so it should keep us slow in judging things down in this life, you know. Keep us really slow. Let's go on. In verse 17, I said in my heart, God shall judge the righteous and the wicked. For there is a time there for every purpose and for every work. Now this is what Olam teaches you. But it's also an observable thing, that there is a judgment that does finally come to all. Verse 18, I said in my heart concerning the estate of the sons of men, that God might manifest them, and that they might see that they themselves are beasts. What is he saying here? He's been talking about how there's a time for everything. And we're all on the treadmill. And so as it ends up, there's no ultimate chief good in this life. And so we're no different than the animals, therefore. We're just like the animals. They don't have a chief good. Well, in this life, we don't have a chief good. And we can't just go to the ultimate supreme utopia, you know. We don't become gods. And so we're just like the beasts. And he goes on and explains it further. Verse 19, for that which befalls the sons of men befalls beasts. Even one thing befalls them. As the one dies, so dies the other. Yea, they have all one breath, so that a man has no preeminence above a beast, for all is vanity. It's just that way. You know, I've done a lot of hunting, and you shoot an animal and he's wounded, and he acts just like a man is shot and wounded. Right. You go to war and guys get shot. You take care of them, patch them up, just like what manholes get shot, get patched up. They don't like it. Neither does man like it. They all die. They quit breathing and then their eyes close and that's it. And that's what happens to a man. That's what happens to an animal. They're all the same. Flesh. You know? We're not some supreme being that's made of gold and flashes fire from his eyes and then these animals. It's not that way. We're flesh, they're flesh. We got to eat to live, they got to eat to live. We die, they die. We have pain when we die, they have pain when they die. We suffer, they suffer. But they got a soul, like we got a soul. They don't like when they get hurt. We don't like when we get hurt. Now, there's something a little bit different about this verse, though, that's missing the King James. That last phrase, so that a man has no preeminence above a beast, more literally, so that man's preeminence is nothing above a beast. In other words, man does have a preeminence. That's visible. That's observable. But man's preeminence is not above the beast. In other words, his preeminence is nothing. It's not doing him any good. Even though he's wiser than the beast, that he's got more capability than the beast, though he's got more insight than the beast, though he's got Olam that the beast doesn't have, yet still, what good is it doing? He dies like the beast. He dies like the beast. There are some animals that live longer than humans. That's why some of the turtles, some of the, elephants? There's some animals that live longer than man. And so our preeminence, what good does our preeminence do to them? And it's because one thing befalls one as befalls another. You see a drought, guess who dies off of the beasts? Man. See? And it seems like these haphazard things of life show that we are, our greatness is no, doing us no good. Verse 20, all go into one place, all are the dust, all are of the dust, and all turn to dust again. And that's true. But notice, one place is dust, because that's observable. And this is one of those verses that prove the viewpoint that Solomon is taking. He's not talking about Sheol or departed spirits or anything like that. He's talking about dust, because we all go to the same place, dust. You bury a man that's dead, dig him up a year later, he's dust. Bury an animal, dig him up a year later, he's dust. It's dirt. Just turned into fertilizer. Man and beast, both. So out of preeminence is nothing. Verse 21. Who knoweth the spirit of man that goeth upward, and the spirit of the beast that goeth downward to the earth? Now here again the translation isn't... It misses a little bit. Better translated, it says, who knoweth whether... Who knoweth whether the spirit of man goes upward? And whether the spirit of the beast goes downward to the earth. Now, spirit here is just speaking of the life force. It's not referring to that Olam. It's used in a different way. Context lets you know. Spirit here is referring to that life force that man has and that animals have. It returns and it's lost. But where does it go? It's assumed that man goes upward, on high, because that's how man walks and he looks. He looks up. It's assumed the man, that beast goes downward because he looks down. His face is to the earth. He goes below. But how do you know? It's not observable. They both go to the dust. Only that eternity in your heart lets you know that. That eternity in your heart lets you know that man goes a different place than the beast does. That his spirit goes up. That is, goes to God. Excuse me. Whereas the beast's life force, it just goes into the dust and it's gone. That Olam inside lets you know that. Verse 22. Wherefore I perceive that there is nothing better than that a man should rejoice in his own works, for that is his portion. For who shall bring him to see what shall be after him? Since you die like a beast, you can't rely on what's going to come after you die. And when you get old, you can't do much anyway, so brother, you better just enjoy everything you can while you got it. Enjoy everything you can while you've got it. And that's the only observable reward. So the best you can do in this life is, brother, relax. Take it easy. Take one day at a time and get the very best out of that day. And be wise, be knowledgeable, keep your eyes in your head so that you can get the very best out of that day. And just learn to be content each day. And if you're dissatisfied and envious and discontent today, you have ruined today. You've ruined it. If you're upset and in trouble, you have ruined today. And therefore you have lost the purpose of today. And if you're in a constant state of anxiety, you'll lose the purpose of tomorrow. And so the best you can do is enjoy today. Because it's all on a treadmill. It's like the guy that, you know, he gets injured. And, oh, he's so anxious so he's not injured. And so he wastes away all the time that he's injured, anxious about being injured, and can't wait until he's not injured. And now he's developed such a pattern of anxiety that as soon as he's not injured anymore, now he's anxious to get all this other stuff done, and he's always in a state of anxiety, and he's never satisfied. Never satisfied. What he should do is say, okay, I'm injured. Now, let's get the best out of now. Well, how can I get the best out of this moment, this day? And tomorrow. And the next day. If you're in a hopeless situation, everything is dark, then you need to stop and say, now look, I've got to get the very best I can out of today. So let me learn from the situation I'm in now. What's the best attitude to take now? How can I get the best and draw the most value out of what I'm going through right now? Remember how God spoke to Job and said, if you're in a trial, instead of being always anxious and upset all the time, just say, what I don't see, teach me. And if I've done iniquity, I'll do it no more. And that way you get the best out of your trial now. And if you're in the glory, get the best out of the glory. And if you're in the ditch, get the best out of the ditch. Draw the best you can out of everything, and life will never defeat you because you're on a treadmill. You're not going to find any chief good, so just get the best you can out of it. All right, chapter 4. Here the creature views the human social scene. And we're going to find that there's no chief good in the human social scene either. And remember, this is part of that general observation. Verse 1. So I returned and considered all the oppressions that are done under the sun. And behold, the tears of such as were oppressed, and they had no comforter. And on the side of their oppressors there was power, but they had no comforter. You've got the oppressed and the oppressor. Now we're looking at the human social scene. The oppressed. Oh, groan. Horrible. And they have no comforter because the oppressor is on his back. But then he looked at the oppressor. Guess what the oppressor is like? Oh, groan. These miserable creatures that we're over. And they have no comforter. Vanity of vanities. There's no ultimate in the human social scene. You think, if anybody was ever on top, it's the one who's got everything under his thumb. He has no comforter either. You know what he's trying to do? He's constantly scrambling to try to keep his life. It's like Herod. Herod the Great. Sure, he got himself all the way up to King of Judea to find out that while he was there, he was sitting on the thinnest little line that any little maneuver and he was going to get killed. His life was constantly being plotted against. His family hated him. His friends hated him. His nation hated him. The Romans hated him. Alright, he scrambled his way all the way to the top for what? He was oppressing the nation for what? The oppressors, the oppressed had no comforter in Judea, and the oppressor had no comforter. For what? There's no chief good, not even in this life. There's no place you can attain on this planet. There's no height that you can attain to in rulership in the human social scene that will give you the ultimate good. It's not there. The more responsibility you got, the more headaches you got. And so you just find your niche and enjoy the niche that you're in. Find your niche. See where your soul takes you. See the opportunities that you have. If aspirations help you enjoy life better, have them. But don't worry about it. And don't get super upset. And don't become an oppressor of man. Because then you certainly won't have any comforter. Okay. Glory. Vanity of vanities. All is vanity.